This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Abortion is legal in Ohio since voters passed a constitutional amendment last year. Now the legal challenges to laws that remain on the books have begun. On Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss what's happening and what it means for accessing care. Plus, Cincinnati City Council is looking into an option to help homeowners pay for spiking property taxes. We'll hear what's involved. And a total solar eclipse is happening Monday. What are your plans for Eclipse Day? We'll be talking about the big event in the final portion of our weekly news review, and we'd love to hear from you. If you want to share your eclipse plans, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Joining me to get us started today on the weekly news review is USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
We're always glad to have you here. Jesse, the passage of Issue 1 last year means abortion is legal in Ohio up to the point of viability, but there are still restrictions in state law. What's the state of abortion care access in Ohio right now?
Yeah, so abortion is legal and being performed up until about 21 weeks, 6 days into pregnancy. And that's because, but there are still a number of laws on the books that are either on hold or maybe in being enforced right now that create barriers to abortion access or, you know, could restrict them if they were reinstituted. And so there's kind of this long legal effort to declare these laws unconstitutional based on what voters approved or to kind of curb some of them. Another route that they could have taken is going through the Ohio legislature to repeal some of those laws, but
did we lose you, Jesse?
That body is controlled by Republicans who are not particularly interested in appealing these.
I see. Right. So I guess I wondered, what did people expect to happen to those laws after Issue 1 passed? Was there some idea that there would be kind of almost automatic repeals, or did everybody know, hey, we're going to need a series of lawsuits if we want to get rid of these laws?
I think the people who brought Issue 1 knew that there was going to have to be some lawsuits and some legal challenges, just given the makeup of the Ohio legislature. So this was anticipated.
Okay. And there's already a lawsuit that's challenging Ohio's law that bans most abortions, right?
Correct. That law, which is sometimes called the six-week ban or sometimes called the heartbeat bill, has really been at the center of a lot of this debate because it did take effect for about a little over 2 months in 2022 after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And so that was the law that had people going to other states to access abortion. And so there's a lot of discussion and controversy over that law. That is being challenged actually in Hamilton County Court. And it seems like all sides agree that that's unconstitutional now with the new language, but it still takes a little bit to work its way through the system.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this new lawsuit related to reproductive rights and the state laws that this one is challenging.
Yeah, so this is really the first new lawsuit that has been filed since Issue 1 passed in November. And it's challenging this 24-hour waiting period and saying the people who brought the lawsuit are saying that it's really not medically necessary. Basically, if you go in to have an abortion, whether that be a procedure or medication abortion, you go in and you have some like counseling about the how far along you might be, and you get some information about alternatives that is like state required literature. And you are not able to have an abortion the day that you have your first meeting with individuals at the abortion provider. You have to wait at least 24 hours. But in reality, it usually ends up being longer than 24 hours because of just challenges, maybe getting off work or childcare or, you know, other hurdles people might face.
And do doctors in Ohio currently face charges if they don't comply with that law, even after the passage of Issue 1?
Yeah, because the law is still on the books, they could face losing their medical license. They could potentially face civil lawsuits if someone challenges that. There are criminal charges associated with performing an abortion after like embryonic or fetal cardiac activity is detected. That law is currently on hold because of, a variety of legal challenges, but there are certainly penalties for not providing this information. And so abortion clinics in Ohio are abiding by that 24-hour waiting period right now.
And you talked about this a little bit, how it's usually or how it's often longer than 24 hours because of time off work and childcare and those sorts of things. Tell us a little bit more about what the lawsuit is arguing is the problem with requiring this 24-hour waiting period.
Yeah, so the doctors who perform abortion in Ohio are saying that they already are required to practice informed consent. So they are already kind of explaining the procedures and potential, risks, or like after just after treatment and so forth to patients. Also, they're saying that patients have really thought about this decision before coming in. And so for many people, like the 24 hours isn't really changing anyone's mind per se. Also, individuals might be coming from out of state where the states have more restrictions or perhaps outright bans on abortion. And so it's just like adding additional challenges for those individuals.
What do supporters of this law say? Why do they say it's important to keep this 24-hour waiting period on the books?
Yeah, so groups like Ohio Right to Life and other organizations that oppose abortion generally say that this is medical information that people should have before they obtain an abortion. They feel like these are like safety practices or, just giving people an extra opportunity to take a breath and consider their decision.
What's next with this lawsuit?
Yeah, so this one was filed in Franklin County, and so both sides will kind of make their arguments about whether these particular requirements are in violation of Ohio's new language in the Constitution, which, guarantees access to abortion and other reproductive decisions like miscarriage care and fertility treatment. And so we're just going to kind of see how these particular rules line up against this new language that voters approved in issue one, and whether this is too much of a burden on Ohio in seeking abortion.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about another news story that has had an impact on a lot of people, and that's House Bill 6. You had an update this week on the state's case against former Public Utilities Commission of Ohio Chairman Sam Randazzo. First, remind us quickly of what the state's accusing him of doing.
Yeah, so Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost filed this lawsuit in Summit, or these criminal charges in Summit County against Randazzo and then two former FirstEnergy executives. And the accusation is that FirstEnergy gave Randazzo $4.3 million to kind of do their bidding, for lack of a better term, to help them out with a law that passed that would bail out two nuclear plants in northern Ohio that was owned by a subsidiary, and to kind of help them in the PUCO, which regulates utilities.
And you reported on some new records that were filed in the case. What did these new records show?
Yeah, so there's a variety of things. One is showing how Sam Randazzo worked on these kind of side deals between utilities and large industrial users who were his clients. And it showed that he was involved in the Duke Energy situation, which was happening earlier in the 2000s and ultimately led to an $80 million settlement. So maybe kind of learned from that experience when he made side deals with FirstEnergy that were less disclosed. The other thing that it showed was really this chummy kind of casual relationship between Randazzo and the FirstEnergy executives. He was sending them pictures of himself in a superhero outfit with like terms like Randazzler around it. He was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in a Christmas photo with some other FirstEnergy folks. And so If this person is supposed to be kind of keeping an arm's length from utilities in order to regulate them and balance their interest against Ohioans' electric bills, for example, this really showed they were much closer than that.
Sam Randazzo, he also faces federal charges, doesn't he?
Correct. Yeah, Randazzo has been charged both in federal court and state court. The First Energy executives, former executives Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling, have only been charged in state court at this point. Everyone has pleaded not guilty, so we're kind of in the early stages of those court cases.
Yeah, and this is such a complicated case, but what are you watching for next with this whole thing?
Yeah, we're kind of looking to see how this involves other individuals and kind of like who knew what about this $4.3 million payment. Governor Mike DeWine's former chief of staff, current close advisor, is one of the people listed as a possible witness for the prosecution in this case and was informed about some payment to Randazzo. So, kind of how early in the vetting process did they know about that is something of interest.
Well, let's talk now about something that so many of us have to deal with, parking and paying for parking with apps on our phones. Full disclosure, I've been known to call these apps annoying. It sounds like there are some state lawmakers who think so too.
Yeah, so there are a number of state lawmakers. It's actually a bipartisan proposal that are s putting forward legislation that would require cash or credit card to be offered at parking meters, in addition to if you're going to have like an app or electronic payment.
So this bill would say, if it were to become law, would say, hey, you can't just have a QR code or some app that you have to download. These meters have to be able to take change and credit cards too.
Correct.
Okay.
And the goal with that, they're saying, is not everyone has a smartphone. Not everyone, wants to use an electronic device to pay for parking. And they say that, there should be other alternatives available. Perhaps you have someone who's less tech savvy, and they should be able to park as well.
Are you hearing opposition to this idea?
So some of the opposition is some of the cities say that they have alternatives to the app in the general area. Maybe not every parking spot allows you to park with coins or credit card, but maybe there's one around the corner or kind of easily accessible. So they question how much it's needed. And then the other concern is the state government playing the role of city government? If you have a concern about apps and electronic payments, should you be going to the Ohio State House or should you raise those concerns with City Hall? There's been a long string of kind of fights over home rule and local control, and the locals are saying that this is just another example of Ohio lawmakers kind of overstepping their role.
Did you hear from cities about why they've made these changes? Is it about reducing theft or administrative costs to have fewer meters that take coins and credit cards?
Yeah, so it does reduce kind of the administrative costs of it. You don't need as many people checking the meters or collecting coins and so forth. Also, during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was kind of this move towards using QR codes and electronic payments and so forth. So people are more familiar with them than they perhaps were before that time.
And under this bill, does this mean every single meter would have to accept cash or credit cards? What do the lawmakers who pr sponsored this say about that?
Yeah, and speaking with the sponsor, they said that they were open to having like just meters in the area as long as it's generally accessible, that it's not just like one meter down at the end and everything else is an app. So we're kind of early in the process for this bill, and I think that's something that would be worked out in committee or before it actually gets a vote on the floor. But their kind of end goal is that, if someone wants to pay with coin or a credit card, that that's an accessible option to them.
Okay, and what's next with this bill?
Yeah, so this was just introduced. So we're kind of early in the process. There's going to be committees. People are going to come in and say, this is a great idea. This is a horrible idea. And here's why. And so we will see. All bills have to be passed before the end of the year, or they have to be reintroduced. And so, we're kind of early in the process at this point.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Jesse Balmer. Thank you so much for your time today, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks. Have a good one.
You too. Up next, Cincinnati City Council has a new proposal to help low-income homeowners with their property taxes. And later in the program, we'll discuss the eclipse. Give us a call to share what your plans are. Call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Council is looking into a new option to help some homeowners pay their spiking property taxes. Joining me now to explain the proposal and who could benefit from it is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for being here, Becca.
Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Becca. Becca, a lot of homeowners have been reeling from these big property tax bills. Remind us why people are seeing these big increases.
Well, we had huge increases in property values, property assessments, this year-over-year increase. And in some neighborhoods that have been particularly huge spikes in those value assessments, it's often because there were either very small increases in the years leading up to that, or no increases, sometimes even decreases. But obviously, the housing market has been kind of wild the last couple of years, and we're really kind of playing catch up on seeing all of those values go up. Now, it's not a one-to-one equation. You know, going up 100% on your value doesn't necessarily mean 100% increase in taxes. But we did also, of course, see a huge increase in taxes across the city, hitting certain neighborhoods more disproportionately than others.
Yeah. And Cincinnati City Council talked about a new proposal to help some of those homeowners. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this would basically be direct cash support for some eligible homeowners who are delinquent on property taxes. This money, it would be $1 million total. So just to say up front, this is not final yet. What's happened is council passed a motion asking the administration to put together this program. Once that program has been put together, it would be in an ordinance form and need another approval from city council. But the motion did get unanimous approval this week. It would take $1 million from other homeowner support funds, that's city money, and basically reallocate them to direct support for taxpayers. Taxpayers. I mean, yes, they are taxpayers, but
yeah.
To property owners is what I meant to say.
Sure.
So it would be just for specific eligible homeowners. It has to be someone who both owns and lives in the home, not renting it to someone else. And it would only be for low-income homeowners. And that is going to be defined by the area median income, making 80% or less of the area median income. So just for example, for a family of four, that would be about $65,000 a year or less.
Okay. And how much money would council allocate for this?
It would be a total of $1 million, assuming they stick with the plan that's outlined in the motion. But details on how much each homeowner would be eligible for are not determined yet. That's something that council has asked the administration to kind of look at what makes the most sense, what would be best practices. So those are details we're not sure on yet.
Yeah. Where would that money be coming from? Where is council getting this $1 million?
So the original source of this is actually ARPA money. So American Rescue Plan Act, which I feel like we've been talking about for 8 years.
Yeah.
But a couple of years ago, it was allocated to cities. Council has already allocated all of that funding, but often things come in under budget or things plans change. So this is coming from other programs that were allocated to help homeowners. Half of it is coming from the American Dream Down Payment Initiative, often just called ADDI, and that's a way, as it sounds, to help folks make a down payment on a home for first-time homeowners. That originally had $2 million in that account, and they're taking $500,000 from that. The other $500,000 is from a pilot program that was planned with the port to train minority developers, and that pilot program basically just has not gotten off the ground yet. Not entirely surprising. It often takes a really long time for things like this to happen, but we didn't get a lot of detail on why that hasn't gone through yet. So there is still money for both of those initiatives still allocated, and Vice Mayor J. Michelle Lemon-Kearney made the point, we can always allocate more money to those funds later on. This is a more pressing immediate need, and so that's the reason for moving those over.
And where does this stand? Did council vote on this proposal this week? I mean, has it been finalized?
Just voted on the motion. Now, it did pass unanimously, so there's obviously support for this. It was partially introduced by Mayor Aftab Pureville as well, so really unanimous across the board approval for this so far. But it cannot be enacted until council votes on an ordinance version that allocates it. And we expect the administration to have much more information about how the program would work when the ordinance is ready to be voted on. So, for example, the vice mayor said they've asked for a 10-day streamlined application process, because obviously if you're delinquent on your property taxes, you want to get that resolved as soon as possible. And so the idea would be they want to make it as quick as possible for someone to apply, get approved, get the financial help.
Yeah. And when that ordinance is developed, would it also have more information about how much people could qualify for?
That's certainly something we expect. And, you know, it could be that it's different amounts for different qualifying factors. It could just be one cap amount. Those are all details we're not sure on yet. But yes, I do expect that information to be in the ordinance.
So how quickly could homeowners start applying for this money? Is there any timeline that you've heard about in terms of the ordinance and all that kind of stuff?
I've not heard a timeline, although, you know, so on the one hand, things like this take a long time. And usually the city will say, we'll have this ready in 2 weeks. And I usually add another couple weeks onto that in my head in terms of when I expect it. That said, this is clearly a priority for all council members and the mayor. And when there's something that's a top priority for that many people, it does kind of push things to the top of the list. So I'd say nothing ready for applications for, I'd say, at least 3 to 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any firm answer on that.
Okay. Well, I know Councilmember Mark Jeffries had floated another idea for money to help homeowners with their taxes. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So there's this really big pot of money. It's $50 million. Again, the original source for this was ARPA, although the city has since kind of replaced that with other city funding so that it can be more flexible. $50 million that the city has set aside because of some ongoing lawsuits related to income taxes and folks who are working from home, especially in 2020 during the pandemic. So the idea is if you work in the city of Cincinnati, you are paying that income tax to the city, but then all of a sudden you're working from home, maybe from your house in Milford or Northern Kentucky. And all of a sudden, the city is still taking that income tax, but homeowners asking me about too many things, Lucy. I can't keep this straight. Workers could ask for a refund from that. So this was basically a pot of money set aside for the city to say, you know, we are liable potentially for this much money to return to taxpayers if, you know, courts determine that we couldn't have collected that. As I said, a couple of different lawsuits. One of the reasons that Jeffries brought this up was one of the lawsuits had a sort of temporary victory or an initial victory where a judge ruled in the city's favor and said, basically, you don't have to issue those refunds. And so Jeffries said, hey, we might have this money available. Could we explore using that for property tax relief? It wouldn't need to be the whole amount, but that was one source he potentially looked at. Some council members immediately were concerned about this and offered some wariness and some concern. Mark Jeffries has kind of been saying, hey, it's just an option. You know, I'm not saying this is definitely the right choice, but I think we should consider it.
Yeah. How did the city administration react to that idea?
Unsurprisingly, very negatively. the report that city administration put forward, the direct quote is, this suggestion raises grave concerns for the administration. For a lot of the same reasons we heard from some council members, basically that this is part of the city's financial reserves. Those financial reserves are in a really healthy place for the first time in years, but not really counting that $50 million, really looking at other reserves. So the administration is saying, yeah, I know we didn't count that, but it is still part of the reserves. They're saying it's still important. We don't want to spend money we have in savings. And basically pointing out that the lawsuit that did get an initial ruling in the city's favor can be appealed. And we don't know yet if that's going to be appealed. There's also a separate lawsuit that is still active. And the city administration, this is basically a note from the city manager saying, even if those lawsuits are resolved, we shouldn't spend this money anyway. Not at all surprising. You know, for example, on property taxes, council made the decision, I think 2 years ago, to end the rollback and decide to use the full amount of property tax allowable in the charter. And the administration has been asking council to do that for years. The administration is always going to take the more fiscally conservative approach to issues like this because they're looking at the budget year after year. Sure. And they're not up for election and have to worry about tax increase questions.
Right, right. We do actually have a caller on the line about this issue. Becca looks excited.
I've never gotten a caller when I'm on the show.
Hey, Mary, thanks for making Becca's day. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
My comment first is I'm grateful that the city is doing something or attempting to do something to address the real estate taxes for low-income homeowners. especially given the resources that they allocate for tax abatements for wealthier homeowners. So there's some level of equity here. I'm concerned about what happens next year and the year after. Like, how sustainable is this? And have they talked about that? Because this is not a one-time thing. It's going to happen over and over again.
Yeah. Thanks for that call, Mary. Appreciate it. Becca, has that been something that's come up during these council discussions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So first, one clarification on the tax abatements. You know, just to make sure that folks understand that the city, when they offer a tax abatement, it's basically saying that that homeowner doesn't have to pay the increase in taxes for a certain amount of years. It's not a direct cash payment the way that this would be. So just one clarification on that. But yes, council has initially talked about this. I think we mentioned Councilmember Jeffries has started this task force. That's one of the things that they are looking at, which is what are the long-term and short-term solutions for this? And then yes, Mayor Aftab Pierville this week when introducing this motion before it was voted on said, you know, we know this is, you know, a life preserver. This is basically just an immediate look at some of the difficulties that are happening right now. But long term, there are going to have to be changes. Now, the city also tends to get a little bit defensive on this question, partly because, you know, they say most of tax policy happens at the county and state level. So, for example, there are certain benefits that homeowners can get if they are low income and seniors. But the city and the county can't decide who's eligible for that. That's something that's decided at the state level. So we have heard a lot of criticism from state and county officials saying to state lawmakers, why have you done nothing to address this? We've known this was coming for a long time, but the state, according to these local officials, has not acted in the way that they need to. So a little bit of defensiveness, but at the same time, some acknowledgement that yes, there is going to be some long-term solutions.
Yeah. Mary, thanks so much for that call. We sure appreciate it. Becca, what other help is available for people out there? You mentioned that Councilmember Mark Jeffries has formed this new task force that's meeting to look at the problem. They're talking about longer term solutions, too, and trying to sort through all that. What other help is available out there for homeowners?
So at the county level, there is still about $1 million in a fund that is available for mortgage, property tax, and utility relief. That's all for homeowners. And that's throughout the whole county, so not just limited to Cincinnati. Applications are being processed right now. You can apply for that at 513relief.org. Again, that's through the county, so both city and county residents are eligible for that. It's an interesting note because I'd have to double check this, but I think the original amount that the county approved for that was $2, $3, or even $4 million a couple of years ago. And it took a long time to get some of that money out the door. One of the difficulties is contacting people who are eligible to receive that funding and getting them through the process of verifying income, verifying homeownership, that kind of thing. And so that money has been available for a while, but hasn't necessarily been taken advantage of. And that's something that I think the county has been trying to push out and get more folks aware that that is available as well.
Yeah. We have a caller, Tim, on the line. I apologize. We won't be able to take your call, Tim, because we're running out of time. He wanted us to talk about the role that private equity plays in this, investors who purchase these homes, and how I know a lot of people argue that's been driving up prices. Those are great questions, Tim. I'm sorry we don't have time to get into them, but we certainly have explored that in the past and we'll explore that in the future. So thank you for calling and for listening. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks so much for your time today, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll help you prepare for Monday's total solar eclipse. Want to share your plans? Now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Eclipse frenzy has hit the tri-state. We're going to help you prepare with some do's and don'ts for watching, and if you're not excited, we'll talk about some reasons you might want to be. Want to share your plans? Now's the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Joining me now are WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome back, Tana.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU general assignment and long form reporter Nick Swartzell. Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
First, we've been talking about the eclipse all day, but first, Tana, I want to talk to you about another issue you reported on this week, and that's bird flu. I've been hearing reports of this highly contagious avian flu that cows are getting. and now it's in Ohio. What's going on with that?
All right. This is not the kind of animal I like to bring you.
No. You don't like sick ones. No.
So, of course, I'm sure people have seen in the national news about the avian flu that has transmitted to cattle, I believe also some cats.
You just really upset me with the cat thing, but please go on.
I'm so sorry, Lucy.
That's okay.
And one human that we're aware of in Texas. So basically, it's in humans, we think of it as the novel avian influenza A, H5N1, in the cattle and whatever we're calling it, highly pathogenic avian influenza.
Okay. And how some cows in Ohio have this. Is it worrisome for people? Should we be worried about that?
No. Let's talk about how it got there.
Okay.
The short answer is no.
Okay.
But to backtrack. So it kind of first happened in Texas. So far, there have been other cases in New Mexico and I think Idaho, Michigan, Kansas, and now this one in Ohio that was announced this week. Basically, this dairy in Texas that had some cows sent them up to a dairy in Wood County, which is up near Bowling Green, Toledo, that area. They sent some cows up there about the beginning of March, and then other cows from that dairy in Texas later tested positive. They started looking sickly and they tested positive for this HPAI. And then some of the cows up here in Wood County also started showing some signs of being sick and then just tested positive this week.
And what happens to the cows? Do they have to be euthanized? I know birds who get this are in trouble.
It's really bad for the poultry industry. Apparently not quite as bad. I mean, it's not great for the dairy industry, but not as bad for the animals. According to the director of the Ohio Department of Agriculture, Brian Baldridge, they'll just kind of get better the way, you know, we beat something. So for now, they still have to get milked because dairy cows, kind of require that. So they're still getting milked, but that milk is diverted out of the production process. And even if it weren't, the pasteurization process would kill that. So, you can get into a whole discussion about raw milk, but pasteurization would kill any of that bacteria anyway.
Okay. I know we have a couple of Eclipse callers on the line. We're going to get to that in just a moment. Please hold. So, Tana, you said that the milk that's pasteurized gets treated. Should this make people worried about their milk and yogurt and cheese?
No. Brian Baldridge says that, Ohioans are not in any danger. There's lots of safeguards in place in the with the pasteurization and all of those processes and the milk being diverted from it all together. Says keep drinking that. And of course, the risk of jumping to another human is also pretty low. Like the human that got it was in direct contact. And it's only the second case of it jumping to a human. The first was in 2022. So they've kind of locked down this dairy in Wood County. And so the risk is low, and the dairy products in Ohio are safe.
Okay. Well, thank you. Now we're going to move to Eclipse Talk.
Eclipse.
Oh my gosh, I did that and you picked up on it and I wasn't even trying to put something down. Done, Tana. Well done. We're going to start with a caller. Hey, Ross, thanks so much for calling. Tell us about your plans for the eclipse or whatever eclipse stuff you want to talk about.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
Excellent. I'm in the car. So I just wanted to say that I attended the eclipse in Hopkinsville. It was in a zone of totality from Cincinnati, drove to Hopkinsville, Kentucky in 2017, which was about a four-hour ride. And fortunately, on that day, it was really bright sunshine. And people say this, it's a life-changing event, and it's actually becoming cliche, but it really is to stand on the ground and it'd be bright sunshine, and to, have the glasses on and to witness it happening, to see the other things around, the shadows and the animals, and, it's truly a once-in-a-lifetime event. So I would encourage people to go, and to, if you're in Ohio, get within that 124 band of totality, because it will not be the same if you're not in the band of totality. And then the other thing is just to be prepared for is that this year, I actually organized an event, and it's going to be in Bellefontaine, Ohio, which is in totality. But for listeners to just be mindful of the traffic, coming back, because it was quite a experience coming back from Hopkinsville, still well worth it. And then I would also, just for the folks, just make sure they understand to get ISO certified solar glasses so that they can protect their eyes. And other than that, you know, I really didn't have my phone or iPad going during that 2.5 minutes or so, and don't plan to do it. I was actually just looking at the event. So I would encourage people, for that time, you can hit your camera to record something, but really try to enjoy the moment. So I just wanted to share to the zone of totality and be safe.
Well, thank you so much, Ross. Man, you stole some of our thunder for some of what we're going to be talking about, but that's okay. We really appreciate your calling. Glad it was such a great experience. Tana, you know, Ross is telling us you gots to be in that path of totality. And apparently it's going to really freak out cows and chickens and all kinds of stuff that are that are there. Are Ohio and Indiana in particular are expecting a lot of people for this, aren't they, Tana?
Yeah. So they're both, especially just, you know, 20 minutes north of where we're sitting here and, you know, where a lot of our listeners are listening, especially WMUB listeners in the Richmond and Fountain City and all those areas, and all kind of through Dayton and Fairfield and Butler County. ODOT, you know, the Ohio Department of Transportation, the Ohio EMA, they're expecting like hundreds of thousands of people to flood those areas.
Wow. Okay. And where are they all going to go to the bathroom? Our producer, Selena Reeder, is really, really worried about this. Do you have any idea?
Oh my gosh. Nobody planned, no one prepped me to be able to talk about potties. I don't know. That's a good question.
Okay. That's okay. Well, Selena is a very industrious person. I know she'll figure it out. I have great faith in her. And she has a son and husband. We know how they'll go to the bathroom. But
Get those astronaut diapers.
Okay, there we go. Astronaut diapers. Yeah, Selena's very excited. Thank you.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, we have another caller. Hey, Chuck, thanks so much for calling. What is your eclipse comment or question? Where are you going to be?
Well, I'm going to be in Greenville, Ohio. My my son-in-law is from there, and Greenville is in the path of the total eclipse. And it'll be great because back in the 1950s and then again in the 90s, I built pinhole shadow boxes to watch the eclipse. So this will be the first time that I can actually look directly at it.
Oh, you got some fancy glasses?
No fancy ones. I've got ones left over from 2017. So just the little cardboard things. But it'll be a great thing to be able to look at it without glasses when it's in fully eclipsed.
Well, now, Chuck, I got some bad news for you, because I think Dean Regas, our astronomer friend, says don't take those glasses off when it's fully eclipsed. Am I right about that, Marshall? I think you're supposed to keep them on.
I think you're
when it's fully eclipsed. Okay, I just lied to you, Chuck. I'm sorry. When it's fully eclipsed, you're right. You can take those glasses off, but I know
totality,
you'll be safe if you're in the zone of totality. So you're going to be in a great place for it.
Yeah, that's where Annie Oakley is from.
Wow. Okay.
That's where our colleague here.
My son-in-law, being from there, should be able to find us a good place to watch from. That's going to be the tough thing.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of people out there.
Okay. Well, good. Yeah. And if he doesn't, then he's going to have to pay for it at Thanksgiving. So.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks so much for calling. We appreciate it. Bye-bye. So, Tana, I know I stumped you with the bathroom question, although you came up with an excellent answer. what's the number one thing people need to do to that? Is it all about planning?
It's definitely about planning. Be patient, plan on traffic, you know, get there early, stay late. Don't try to rush out right afterward, you know, like a fireworks show. Plan on hanging around. That's when they're especially expecting the most traffic on the highways and, you know, the roads leading to some of the biggest viewing locations, is everybody trying to leave at once. Make sure you have some snacks, of course. You know, everybody is going to try to hit up the same Taco Bell or whatever at 4:10, right? So have your snacks. And then the biggest thing that ODOT, the Ohio Department of Transportation, says that they learned from other states that have been in the path of totality is make sure you have your car fully gassed up so that you're not, if you're stuck in traffic, you're not running out of gas. Now, if you are a poor planner and you're not listening to us right now, they will have their ODOT folks out on the roads with stocked with gas, because this is what they learned, so they can, as he said, give you a little splash and get traffic moving again.
A little splash of gas. We got an email from Penny. Penny emails, we've rented a house in Liberty, Indiana, so that we can avoid all the traffic. There are three couples going, and we're fully equipped with proper glasses. I sure hope the weather cooperates with Penny, because that's another thing, too, right? Like, if it's cloudy, that's a mega bummer, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not going to comment on the weather forecast that currently exists. We're just going to hope it clears up.
Thank you. Okay. So, Nick, there are people who aren't that excited about the eclipse. I don't want to say my husband's one of them, but I guess I just did. So, tell us. You talked to some scientists about reasons to be excited. What opportunities is this eclipse going to give scientists who study the sun and the earth?
So some scientists are hyped. I'm hyped too, just to throw it out there. I'm very excited about this. But so there's a lot of opportunity to learn some things about the sun and animals and maybe even ourselves a little bit coming with this eclipse. And I think the first thing is, so we're nearing the solar maximum is what scientists call it. And the sun's energy is not consistent, which I can relate to. I'm Friday after lunch nearing my solar minimum personally right now. Over an 11-year cycle, the sun kind of waxes and wanes. And right now it's at almost its peak. And so that gives scientists this opportunity to see the sun in a unique situation as it's like putting it all out there. So that's really cool, first thing. So the second thing is, as the eclipse happens, as the totality happens, scientists will be able to see the sun's corona much better. That's the sort of like atmosphere around the sun, very layman's terms. I'm probably not getting that quite right, but you can think of it that way. And the part of the corona nearest the sun is always like sort of like shined out by the brightness of the actual sun. So this is an opportunity for scientists to see that part of the corona in ways that they haven't seen it probably in a long time or ever. So that's really cool. There's also some ways that the science can look at the ionosphere. That's like the layer of the like atmosphere that's closest to space. Ionosphere, I think, is how you say it.
That sounded fancy.
And so there's some things they can learn about the ionosphere while the eclipse is happening. So that's really cool. Now, there's some other stuff, too, that I'm just, like, really excited about. Mm-hmm. So scientists are going to also be studying how birds and insects and bats react to the eclipse as a way to learn, like, more about how animals perceive their world, which is really cool to me. Like, you know, we don't really think about, like, well, what do animals think when the sky goes dark all of a sudden, when it gets colder? And how they're going to do this, at least some of them, is weather radar. You can use weather radar to track the migratory patterns of birds and insects and bats, like, there's actually a really cool website where you can watch that happening. And I don't remember the website off the top of my head, but I'm going to put it in the web story, which I forgot to do. So anyway, they're going to look at sort of the patterns of birds and bats and some insects as the eclipse happens and compare it to, you know, similar populations outside the path of totality. So I think that's really neat.
Yeah. I will be studying my cats and they will think it's dinner time. I think is how they will react, but who knows? Yes. But totally. Please, Nick, go on.
Our cats will figure out a way to make it about treats for them. Yeah. They're going to meow for treats probably. lastly, I think I find this really interesting. Sometimes scientists are going to look at how the eclipse affects people, how it affects our sort of like, outlook on the world. Past eclipses, they've done some studies, I think mostly like polls prior to the eclipse and then afterward about how people are feeling about themselves, how people are feeling about the world around them. And they found, you know, and I think there's more study to be done on this, that people felt a little more humbled. They felt a little bit more wanting to connect with other people after they witnessed the eclipse based on this idea of awe, this idea of like, whoa, this is a kind of like it changed my brain watching this, you know, like it changed my perception of where I am in the universe. So, generally, scientists have said they found more pro-social attitudes and behaviors after the eclipse. Now, whether the waiting in traffic 6 hours after the eclipse is over cancels that out, I'm not sure. But so those are some of the things that scientists are going to be looking at, which is cool.
I wonder if your sense of humble is like less if you're not in the path of totality, like if it decreases by the amount of, you know, I don't know. I can be a control case because as I mentioned, my husband is not all about this. So speaking of the path of totality, I want to clarify, I don't want anybody to burn their eyeballs. this is the deal about whether you can look at the eclipse without glasses. If you're in the path of totality and the eclipse is at 100%, you can look without glasses. But if you're in places like Cincinnati where it's 99.9%, do not look at the eclipse without glasses. I don't want anybody to burn their eyeballs because of something I said on the radio or a podcast.
Right. So. And if you don't have glasses, there's still lots of ways to sort of experience the eclipse. Like the most common thing that you could just do is stand with your back to the sun and find a tree that has a lot of leaves on it and then look down at the ground and the space created between the leaves. You should be able to see sort of the crescent of the thing. You can also do this by making like a waffle. Take your two hands together. Again, stand with your back to the sun. Make your fingers into a waffle. And same thing, the space in between. Or the easiest thing is just go in the kitchen and get a colander. and we'll dump the spaghetti out first. Yeah. You know, and then those little pinholes in the colander will create, it'll let you see the crescent on the shadow on the ground.
I'm going with waffle hands. Even though I have glasses, I've never heard of waffle hands, but I want to be part of that. Tana, you also did a story, and we're running out of time, but you reported on, you know, these eclipses have been happening for thousands of years. Tell us about, just a little bit, about how researchers and citizens of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma have been exploring how their ancestors looked at eclipses.
Yeah, so they've been doing all of this language research, the Miami Center at Miami University that works with the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Of course, we sit in their traditional homelands. And they looked at the words that they used, and the words they used to describe these past eclipses were talking about the sun and the moon dying as they, you know, as they cross over, but also knowing that it's, even though it's dead, they know it will come back to life. So the words that are used in the Miami language, it kind of explain that. And then that would be sort of marked by having loud expressions and noises to encourage the sun to come back to life. So a long time ago, they would have maybe shot arrows or shot guns up at the sun or yelled and screamed. They won't be doing that today. There's a lot of folks in Oklahoma where most of the tribe members are now that are planning to go see the eclipse elsewhere. But they said they will just be donning their eclipse glasses safely like everybody else.
That's exciting. I love that. And I love the fact that it wasn't about an end. It was almost about
it's kind of like a rebirth sort of thing, right? It's an understanding that things will be reborn.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I'm excited about Eclipse Day. Hope you all are too. I've been talking with WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner and WVXU general assignment and long form reporter Nick Swartzell. Thank you both so much for your time today.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great weekend and a terrific eclipse day. I hope you get in the path of totality if you're about that. I hope if you are about that, you don't get stuck in traffic. And I hope there's not a run on adult diapers before Selena can get to the store. Thanks for listening.